This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
What's up? It's Jenny LSQ. Welcome to episode 17 of my LSQ podcast, which, more importantly, is part two of an interview with Connor Oberst of Bright Eyes and Desaparecidos and Beyond. Thanks to everyone who checked out the first part and for all your sweet feedback as well. By the way, you can always reach me on Twitter, at Jenny LSQ. So just to catch you up on the first half of the interview, in case you haven't gotten to it yet, we talked about Connor's earliest childhood musical influences. Things like tagging along with his older brothers to all-ages punk shows in his native Omaha, or hanging out and learning everything he could at the local record store. We also discussed his high school band, Commander Venus, and some hilarious memories from that era, and the initial recordings as Bright Eyes. And in this second part of the interview, you'll hear us discuss how some of Connor's more contemporary influences entered the picture, specifically Bob Dylan. And we'll delve into Connor's songwriting and lyric writing process, which I just find so fascinating as someone who regards Connor as one of the finest lyricists of his generation, or, you know, in my opinion, any other, for that matter. Also, don't forget, if you're listening to this podcast when it's still new, Connor and his Mystic Valley band are on the road right now. Check ConnorOberst.com for more info, but you don't want to miss that show if you can possibly avoid that particular feeling of absence and loss. Life's hard, but you can go to some good shows, you know? All right, let's get into it. Connor, part two on LSQ. After you went, like, as a kid into this super hyper deep dive into, like, Indian punk stuff or whatever, when did you start revisiting the even older stuff, you know, the your sort of, like, Bob Dylan-y stuff?
Same thing, like, back to the record store and back to, like, Simon Joyner and back to, like, my older friends, where it's, like, you know, nobody knows who Simon Joyner is, so it's, like, that's why it's, like, kind of, like, funny to, like, even say it this way, but, right. Like, you know, probably the reason I like Bob Dylan, and of course, I remember learning to play, like, Blow in the Wind when I was, like, 10, you know, but whatever, like, my parents were not, like, Dylan heads, they were, like, I mean, they had, like, his greatest hits or whatever.
Right.
But, like, you know, I'm a huge Dylan fan and have subsequently absorbed, like, all of his records. Well, maybe not the last, like, 10, but up until the Frank Sinatra records. No, but, like, all of my, I guess, affinity for what you'd call kind of folk or, like, country stuff. Like, my favorite, like, Townsman's Aunt, John Prine, Dylan. I mean, even my parents were, like, Neil Young fans, but even, like, you know, more deep dive shit on Neil Young and just kind of, like, who I would consider my, you know, long-term heroes all came from kind of a backhanded way of, like, this is influential to
this other thing you
this
like.
This other thing I
yeah,
like.
Yeah.
Or, like, this, like, lo-fi 90s tape culture, you know, Joyner and John Donnell and
yeah.
Lou Barlow.
I mean, same. Like, I mean, I think that's, like, how you do it, right?
Yeah.
Is you're like, okay, where did they get it from?
Yeah.
And, you know.
And because of the record store, they were able to be like, and listen to this. And this is, you know what I mean? Like, and here's this Kris Kristofferson record, or here's this Townsend Zane record, or here's this, you know, Phil Oakes record, or whatever. Like, this
right.
stuff that I probably would have never come to on my own, but because I knew that it influenced like these more current artists that I was admiring at the time, made me interested enough to go and investigate their like predecessors, which no offense to all of them, but I ended up in a lot of cases liking the predecessors more, you know, but I had to get there somehow.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, Dylan is like weirdly like the gift that keeps on giving to me. Like, I feel like there's, I mean, so many amazing records and amazing, even when like the music is like not exactly that interesting. It's just, I mean, just the word, because I'm, you know, obviously like I think about words a lot and think about words to melody lines a lot. And yeah, I mean, there's a reason why he's like kind of like not really disputed as like the best songwriter, because it's like, yeah, for that thing,
yeah,
he is empirically, like empirical evidence, he's like the best.
Right.
That thing.
Right. Well, he's the best Bob Dylan there will ever be. Right. That's for sure.
And I feel like, you know, I feel like what I do is similar enough that I would be bullshitting if I wasn't like, yeah, obviously, like, Bobby D is fucking sick, dude. Yeah. I mean, like,
Shit
is, it's hot. I mean, sure, you can get into, like, the weeds and there's 1,000 missteps or not that great of songs, but the guy's written, how many songs has that guy written? Like, thousands of songs.
Yeah.
It's like, well, and if you're all a songwriter interested in, like, words and, like, you know, like, putting the human experience into, like, a rhymed meter situation, how will you not celebrate that guy's contribution to the world? Because he's the best at that. You know, you can, like, dance around the issue. I felt like when I was a kid, like, 20, whatever, early 20s, and I got the whole bullshit fucking new Dylan thing, which was like, sucks if you're a songwriter and you're just trying. And I never felt like I was like, compared to a lot of people, I never felt like I was like particularly like emulating Dylan. I was like, guy with a lot of words in my songs, you know?
Yeah.
Basically, like, melodically, I don't think I ever like was trying, you know?
Right. Just a lot of words. The verbiage, yeah.
Yeah, just a bunch of words. And it's like, okay, well, that's what folk music is, for one. And the thing with Dylan is like he admits to it, and I think multiple times, that he, well, obviously he was a Woody Guthrie,
right,
you know, fucking like impersonator.
Right.
I mean, he literally was.
Right.
He literally came to New York City and played Woody Guthrie songs.
Yeah.
And sounded exactly like this dude.
Yeah.
Went and fucking was like a super fan and like tracked him down on like his fucking hospital bed. So he's not immune to that thing that makes you gravitate towards stuff you like. But I don't know. I guess what I was saying is like, when I was getting that, those questions all the time and the, like, labeled that way, I like purposely, which is so like sort of cowardly, and I don't know, I would like play down the fact that I like liked
Dylan,
because I felt like I had to, like in interviews and stuff. I'd be like, oh, no, I don't know, it's cool or whatever.
I like lots of stuff.
I don't think I like really denied it, but I remember being like, you know,
not giving into it.
Yeah. I was like, I'm not gonna like go into like my favorite Dylan songs, because that's like all you're gonna write about if I fucking say that right now, you know?
Yeah. But did you, and obviously Simon Joyner is the point of entry for a lot of this stuff for you, but like when you started writing songs and you were writing lyrics and early on kind of figured out that words appealed to you, but like, was there a series of things you had to do to improve, you know, your wordsmithery?
I mean, obviously I always wanted to be better and I always wanted to make better songs, but like, what is better? And everything is objective and everything is, or I mean, everything is subjective and everything is sort of like where you're at the time when you're like expressing yourself. So,
I mean, did you get to, was there a point where you were, where more revision entered the picture in your process or where,
I think at an earlier age, I would just finish a song and that would be it. Record it. Cause it was oftentimes like finish it, recorded that same afternoon on the four track, and that was the song, and right. that was it. So yeah, as I guess my process of recording and definitely like collaborating with Mike Mogus and the Bright Eyes stuff, and then subsequent like producers and shit, you get more into like, you know, let's work on this more and let's revise, and that definitely crept into like the word or songwriting part of it. Mm. And I wanted to, you know, bring my best, put my best foot forward as far as like what I could do on that aspect of the music. So yeah, I got into the habit of writing like multiple verses for a given song. Mm. You know, whereas maybe I would have, like, you know, say there's three verses in a song, like I would have just done it and that would be it.
Right.
But I got into like, okay, I'm gonna write 12 verses for this song.
Right. So like around Lifted, maybe. Yeah.
And then I'm gonna go back and pick my favorites, which I feel like, which maybe potentially backfired a little bit in the sense of like, I think like a lot of my songs from verse to verse, like jump so heavily, like from.
Because you cut out a bunch of stuff.
Well, or just like, yeah, like I had this thought, I was focused on this thought one day. Right. And then a week later, wrote like an entirely, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like some of my songs suffer from like, what the, what is he talking about? But I also like music. I also like songs like that, that are,
yeah,
even if they jump subject to subject, or just the second verse doesn't feel like it's that connected to the first verse. As long as
it's, I don't know. I don't, I
as
don't
long as it's a ever, good verse.
Right. I don't, yeah, know. I think, I don't think you have that problem,
yeah,
at all. I, yeah, mean, the opposite. I think your songs have a high rate of continuity in terms of like, once there's, once the kind of idea is, once the listener is clear on what the idea is, there's, it's very kind of consistent in terms of like sticking to different ways of looking at that idea or something.
Yeah. No, I, for the first time in my life, just the other day, I was doing this like, which happens all the time here in LA, but I never have done it really in my life, which is like trying to like co-write
like, oh, a damn, person. Yeah.
So I was trying to do it. And I'm terrible at it. I realized that for starters. But then I feel like so much of my songwriting process is like, you know, I don't know, just very like individualized to the way my brain works, that it's hard to transfer to other people. And I think that's why my songs have, I don't know, maybe a strange, not strange, but there's a, I guess I'm, what I'm trying to say is I'm envious of certain abilities of like my friend Taylor Goldsmith from Dawes. He's a guy, he just can write a perfect song after a perfect song. It always comes back around. It always,
the metaphors, like, and stuff.
It connects, yeah, to the theme of the song, and it's like beautifully packaged, perfect. Or like Gillian Welch and Dave, like those kind of songs, those kind of people write, they like, it's, I love their songs, and they are so perfectly developed and executed. It's like,
it's, I don't, thorough,
know. Yeah. And it's like, you know, turning in, and I don't mean that, that's maybe would sound like a slight or something, but I mean it as a compliment, which is like, it's like turning in like a beautiful fucking thesis for your like doctorate of songwriting. Like every time they finish a song, it's like, dang.
Right.
Like, now this is a, like, put that in the American canon of great songwriting. You know, like, you did it. Ding, ding, ding. You know, and I feel like my shit's always too fucked up and, like, weird and not understandable.
I was just thinking about that story that you told me about when you were sort of ended up doing an impromptu performance for a class of Berklee School of Music students, where you were, where you just thought you were going to be visiting, and then you were asked to play a song. And after the song, you were, the students, you know, could take, you could take questions. And what was the question? What'd she ask?
she asked, she raised her hand and she said, this is after like a few questions about like, what's it like to like ride on a tour bus? And then this sweet girl raised her hand and she said, so you don't care if you sing in pitch at all? You just don't care. And I tried to be like really like, you know, respectful. I was like, well, I think like, you know, I've never been a trained vocalist. And I think if you express yourself in a way that feels right for you, that's okay. And I gravitate towards vocalists with strange sound, you know, strange, you know, inflections. And, but yeah,
you just don't care at all. You're like, I care a little bit sometimes.
It's like, I care a lot, damn it. I just can't do it. But no, Livingston Taylor, who's James Taylor's brother, was the fucking
professor.
So he's the one that talked me into this whole thing. And then I sing, and then I just was sitting in the class, and then he's like, and no, Mr. Bright Eyes is going to sing a song for you guys. I'm like, damn it. So I'm just trying not to be fucking rude. I'm like,
what song did you do? Do you remember?
I played Lenders in the Temple, okay. Which is was my first solo album, which I had just written. It was like my newest song. But so I played it, and it was very awkward for like 30 students. And then he like stops and he's like, looks around. He gets this big, crazy look on his face. And he's like, looks at the class and he's like, how about those consonants?
Like, wow.
Like, what? But he's,
how about those consonants?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was impressed by how, he's like, he explained that I overpronounce my consonants.
Wow, that's a good, now, that's a good, that's I what get, they teach you to do but, at the Berklee School of
I
Music.
I guess so. That was his big takeaway from my fucking, like, existential dilemma fucking death god song was like, how about those consonants? I was like, Jesus fucking Christ, I don't know how much your fucking parents are paying you to go to school, but get the fuck out.
Oh my god. A lot of songwriters describe, you know, the classic kind of Paul McCartney story, the ham and eggs, yesterday, you know, syllables going with a melody and you gibberish your way through until, is that sort of how the lyric writing begins for you, or are you also writing down phrases that appeal to you as, or turns of phrase here and there?
More both, but I would say more the former. Like my typical like songwriting process is like just either on guitar or piano, finding some chords that feel right or feel good enough to sing to, and then yeah, just like singing gibberish words, you know, back in the day would have been 4-track or something, but now it's like a voice memo on the phone, and getting a sort of semblance of a melody, and then I write the words to the melody. And then I'm really not. Sometimes I'll have some good lyrics, like right off the bat, or like some line or something will come like right with the melody, which becomes like the seed of the song. But a lot of times I just force myself just to get something on the paper, because I feel like phrasing wise and whatever else, it's like I need to solidify the melody, I need to have some words to sing to it,
mm-hmm.
or else it remains kind of like nebulous, where I can't remember it when I go back to play it.
Right.
But if there's words to sing, I will remember it. So I do that, but with the absolute and probably like 98% of the time, like rewrite the words, you know?
Right.
Or maybe I'll like the rhyme scheme. Like I like kind of like how some words sound in the gibberish, like early state. And so I'll be like, okay, like phonetically, I like how this works, but I'm not saying anything interesting or cool or relevant. So I'll focus on finding words that fit phonetically with the chord progression and the demo, but that I like more as right. like poetry, you know?
Right, right. So. And then, so do you sit separately for a period of time, like separate from the melody, separate from the song, as you are really fleshing in the bones of the words? Because it seems like it must be a pretty intensive process, since there are, as you say, a lot of words and sometimes a lot of verses and ideas and some very refined turns of phrase and stuff like that. Like, I mean, is there a lot of time spent just sort of focus only on the words, or do you always have to be kind of listening to the song as you're?
No, I mean, and this is something I like want to actually improve on, which is, I feel like there's more I could do with melodies, and, you know, I tend to like, once I get like my stanza and my melodic structure, I could write 200 fucking verses to the same fucking song, right. You know, it's right. like easy,
right.
You know, about like whatever subject, you right. know, so it's more like focusing like, okay, what do I want this thing to be about? It's great. And that's where, like, you know, collaborating comes in. And, you know, I don't feel like I'm the most like musical person in the world. I'm not like a great guitar player. I'm not like a great piano player. Like I do it in a very like utilitarian fashion. Like where like, I feel like the thing I do that is interesting to the world is like the words and the vocal melody and the sort of presentation of some idea or something that might be interesting to somebody. Like, I'm under no like illusion that I'm like
right.
some kind of sick guitar player
or right.
piano player. But I also am smart enough to like surround myself with people that are very gifted in all those like pursuits. And I've made it part of my life to find those kind of people and attach myself to them and try to bring as much out of them as I can and have them bring as much out of me as they can, and like, you know, marry our talents so that, you know, at the end of the day it might be a complete picture of musicality and poetry and whatever, songwriting and concept, and, you know, I don't know, everything's, it's all like an art project to me. It's like, I want it to be fucking dope. I want like people to like walk away being like, god damn, that's like, is gave me the heebie-jeebies when I heard it. I was like, ooh. Because you know that stuff when you hear it.
Yeah. What shows that you've been to as a fan or as a concert goer do you remember most fondly as having been, you know, like the feeling you hope that people get at your show of like, just, wow, that is fucking zone right there?
I'm trying to think of like ones that have really knocked me off my feet. Like, actually, I saw David Byrne one time at Telluride
Bluegrass
Festival. Yeah. He had probably 20 people on stage. That was like one that knocked me out. Like, some of those cats that like, that are just really like, yeah, they're super popular and they're super long term artists, but until you see them, you don't. I had the same reaction to like Bjork when I saw her. Like, I went with my friend Nikki from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, like, open for her, like, this is in Boston, like, I don't know, fucking 2004 or 5 or something. I went and saw her play. She had, like, a crazy dope band, like, a harp player and, like, all these singers. You know, just, like, some shit you see, you're just like, ooh, this is, like, out, like, this is, like, too potent to really even digest. I actually saw fucking Beyonce at a some weird like Irish or some fucking festival, but I got, because of our because we were playing too, but I had like a, the right badge or whatever, so I gotta be like kind of like in the barricade,
right,
just watching her do her power. I was like, yeah, of course this is like one of the most powerful women in the world. She is like amazing. Like, she is like fucking queen of fucking pop music. Like, I get it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even like listen to her records, yeah, but I was just like,
holy shit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a testament to like, I don't know, you can talk endlessly about like how marketing or record labels or radio or whatever like fools people into like buying into like a bunch of bullshit, which is true, but there's also something true about, there are some people that like fundamentally at their core are so interesting and such, so artistic and so intriguing that people are drawn to them like a fucking moth to a flame. Like, that's just, you can't, like, there's no denying it. You know, it's just, like, people go to it. I saw, I played the same stage as fucking Hall & Oates in Europe like a couple summers ago. And like, you know, like Hall & Oates from, you know, like when I was a kid. They were fucking ruled.
Yeah.
I was just like, they were like old ass dudes from Detroit just crushing some weird fucking soul rock music in the middle of like, you know, fucking Denmark or wherever the fuck it was.
Yeah.
And he's like, it was insane.
Yeah.
I was like, there's, you don't get this good by like, no, they've been doing, like, they've literally been doing this since the 60s. And they are just this good.
Yeah. That's like Lionel Richie too. Yeah. Like, if you see Lionel Richie live, you're just like, oh yeah, Lionel Richie is a fucking amazing performer and has a million awesome songs.
Yeah. Exactly. And you're,
it does restore one's faith in that this, that at least sometimes the things that are popular because they're legitimately the best things. Exactly. You know? Yeah.
And like, yeah, if you can do that for that long and be, I think, not a facsimile of something else, like when you, listen, everyone's influenced and everyone's inspired by stuff, but I think that, to me, that's like the real cut and dry shit. It was like, where it's like, if you can stay in the business long enough and keep putting out like creative output long enough, that you become a thing that is like singular to your vision. I think that's what every like artist should like try to get to, which is just like, it doesn't matter what it is and it doesn't matter what it takes to get there.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
That's what I respect, anyway. It's like, if you can become a singular version of yourself where no one else is going to confuse you with anyone, they're just going to be like, oh, that's that. That's that girl. That's that guy. You know? Yeah. I know who that is. Sounds like them. You know? And if people imitate you, fine, but they're a facsimile. Like, if you are your, like, singular self, then, like, I feel like you've won, you know, like you've, in the world of like, the fucked up world of like, creative commerce entanglements, you know, where like the money is fucking the artistry and vice versa or whatever, but like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. if you can become yourself in a public forum. And then, I mean, I think that's the first goal. And then the second goal, if you can create that and then achieve, like, longevity, then you've, like, really won. Then you've, like, that's, to me, that's, like, the ultimate goal. It's like, be like your undeniable self, whatever that is, and produce art for people, and then continue it, you know,
until, for as long as you want.
Exactly. And or yeah, until old fucking mother cancer tears you down or whatever the fuck gets you. Timmy Taylor fucking car crash. But yeah, you know, you just, that's the coolest, that's what I admire in people, you know, something to aspire to. You know, I just want to make stuff that resonates with me, and you know, I think that if I make art that feels right and relevant and like personal and immediate to me, there'll be some segment of the population of the world that will feel similar and will, you know, in their, you know, it's kind of like passing the hat at this point, but it's like, yeah, there'll be some people that'll somehow give me money, whether it's giving, you know, buying a t-shirt or going to a show or paying for a fucking stream or down, whatever it is, who right. cares? But there'll be enough people
that put a dollar that, forward.
Right. That'll sustain me to continue my life and not have to get another job. And that is a beautiful thing. And I'm very grateful.
All right. Well, I think we're...
We did it?
I think we did it.
I think we actually talked like normal people.
We did.
But I think I did good today.
You did great. You did great.
I think I said what I meant to say. And
thank you so much for doing this. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of episode 17 of LSQ. Thank you so much for listening. And, of course, major thanks to Connor Oberst. Love you, dude. And thanks to all the folks at NAG Management and Nonesuch Records for their help and support. In the next episode of LSQ, a conversation with Leon Bridges. That's coming up in a few weeks. After that, Dirty Projector's Dave Longstreth is my guest. Subscribe now so you get those episodes the minute they come out. And as I mentioned earlier, you can always reach me with questions and feedback on Twitter, @JennyLSQ. And also, before we go, one last thanks to the wonderful Greta Morgan of Springtime Carnivore, who wrote and recorded the LSQ theme song, and who's going to be on the road in Vampire Weekend as a touring member of the band in the months ahead. Yay! We love you, Greta. All right, talk to you next time.